I think I've got them this time. He repeated this statement three times to Donald Morrison, the constable who walked the city centre beat, whom I've interviewed up in his home in Benbecula. Donald also swore an affidavit attesting to the number of occasions Special Branch broke into Willie's office premises, stole his documents, photocopied them and returned them. Anyway, Constable Morrison held up traffic to let Willie do a U-turn and head north to the Kyle of Loch Alsh. Two cars subsequently identified the Special Branch, followed at speed, going through on red at Sauchie Hall Street. The next morning, Willie's car was found in a remote Highland Glen. He was near to death. He was found by two Australian tourists who were driving along a desolate stretch of the A87 in northwest Scotland. They saw his maroon-coloured Volvo had come off the road. There was a man in the driving seat, alive but in bad shape. They flagged down another car which happened to contain a doctor, as well as a Scottish National Party councillor who recognised Willie. They called the cops and they called the ambulance. The gun was found some distance from the car. His pocket belongings had been piled neatly on a rock nearby. He was in a coma, still strapped to the driver's seat, as he still used one of those old immovable seat belts unknown to a younger generation. And he stank of whiskey. A half-empty bottle of Grouse was found inside the car, unbroken, despite the fact that the car had rolled over and over down a steep hill. But Willie only ever drank Glenmorangie or Islay Mist. I have copies of the list of items released as his personal belongings after his death, and the two bottles he'd purchased in Glasgow were missing, arguably because they would have had Constable Morrison's fingerprints on them. His briefcase was lost at the scene, but then recovered, but the files were missing. He was taken to Inverness and then transferred, still in a coma, to Aberdeen, where they found he'd been shot in the head. The post-mortem found no alcohol in his blood, despite stinking of booze, but theatre staff washed the body before the post-mortem and so cleared away all traces of powder burn. The closer the gun to the head, the narrower the soot deposit. Theatre staff had cleaned his hands, and so no soot deposits were found in his hands. But one of the ways that suicide is evidenced is it proves that a gun had been held. Sorry, I'm getting interference there. The coroner decided on a verdict of suicide before the gun had been recovered. So it couldn't have known which gun had been used. The crash was in the Friday night. It was found in the Saturday, dead in the Sunday, post-mortem in the Monday, suicide announced on the Tuesday. Efficient or rushed? In Glasgow, it takes 3 weeks for that process to take place. In Inverness, it took 3 days. No newspapers at the time carried the story of the bullet wound, just a car crash. I spent 5 days in the Mitchell Library looking at microfiche, and I couldn't find any comment about the bullet wound. The nurse who treated him travelled to England shortly afterwards and was unaware of the controversy. Catherine McGonigal was working at the time in the intensive care department at Forrester Hill Hospital in Aberdeen. A few months ago, she resurfaced and testified that the bullet hole was in the nape of the neck, not his temple, as was first reported. She received the X-ray of the skull and showed it to the doctor. She told him that the X-ray showed a bullet in the brainstem. She rolled the patient onto his side to wash him, and it was then she saw the bullet wound at the back of his neck. She testified, and I quote, "The entry wound was right at the back of the neck. There was no exit wound. It was smaller than a one penny piece and was aimed directly at the brainstem." However, Willie was prone to depression. He enjoyed a drink. He had two outstanding court cases pending for drunk driving. So was it suicide? The authorities have insisted no fatal accident inquiry will take place, which has allowed a small cottage industry to spring up. There are many, many more details, but all in the book. And I also weave a story around these facts, which is intended to be entertaining. There's even a love interest for the romantics among us. And I conclude the book with two chapters. One lists the contested facts, and one offers the author's view on the only four possibilities of his death. Natural causes. Unlikely, because he had a bullet in his head. Accident. Well, who knows, because there was no fatal accident inquiry allowed, but an accident which suggested that by accident he discharged a firearm into the base of his neck is unlikely. Was it suicide or was it murder? And if so, more controversially, was it state-sponsored murder? But for those who might purse their lips at conspiracy theorists, let me offer context. Much is from my latest book, The Last Colony, which argues that Scotland is the British Empire's last colony and that they'll do anything to hold on to the assets that Scotland provides. As democratic Scotland works to secure its independence from the rest of the United Kingdom, ever more frantic attempts are being made by the British establishment to influence and suborn the democratic wishes of the Scottish electorate. Internationally, the British establishment has been well used to dealing with upstart nations. There are 195 countries in the world today, and Britain has invaded or otherwise thrown rocks at all but 22 of them. So the British Empire didn't develop following cheese and wine parties and a subsequent measured analysis by nation states of the benefits of the protection of the British Crown. Rather, Britain has a history of creating colonies by employing cruelty, pillage, theft of natural resources, slavery, war crimes, murder, and blood. And not without reason was the Union flag of the United Kingdom referred to as the butcher's apron. But the butcher's apron also flew over the mainland of the United Kingdom, and the British establishment was just as energetic in the protection of its interests closer to home. Domestically, the UK and intelligence services had form. Files released under the Freedom of Information Act show that as early as April 1951, the security services took a mild interest in the SNP, but their agent merely took notes at a meeting at which Robert McIntyre, first MP, spoke. Well, times change. In 1969, violence erupted in Northern Ireland and the British government became involved in a bloody campaign that was to last for a quarter of a century. Over 3,000 lives were lost, and the British establishment went to great lengths to use all the powers at its disposal, including the black arts of the security services, to meet their objectives. But heaven help anyone if it was decided that they required to be interrogated, as the British military had extensive overseas practice in utilizing techniques of hooding, sleeplessness, beatings, sensory deprivation, and starvation. These instruments of torture were most recently deployed in Malaya, Palestine, Cyprus, Aden, Kenya, and Malaysia, among other countries. It was only when they were deployed on British shores that a measure of unease became evident within the body politic in the United Kingdom. The American Journal of International Law cited the British powers which it had conferred on its own security forces, and I quote, "The following are prohibited: violence to life and person, in particular mutilation, cruel treatment and torture, outrages upon personal dignity, in particular humiliating and degrading treatment." Very civilized. Unfortunately, for the poor souls who were subjected to British interrogation, a further qualifying clause also governed the behavior of the men and women silhouetted by the bright lights. And again, I quote, "The precise application of these general rules in particular circumstances and is inevitably to some extent a matter of judgment on the part of those immediately responsible for the operations in question." This clause effectively gave carte blanche to British interrogators and subsequently resulted in the British government being found guilty of torture by the European Court of Human Rights in 1976. And in more recent years, the security services have gone beyond their mere note-taking role and have infiltrated all of the major opposition parties in the UK. They'd placed MI5 operatives at the heart of a number of trade unions and had inserted undercover officers within the anti-nuclear movement, in some cases developing intimate relationships to deepen their cover. Infiltration was by no means constrained to organisations within Northern Ireland. According to a report obtained by the Guardian newspaper, the Socialist Workers' Party alone had 24 undercover officers deployed over a 37-year period. The scale of this infiltration lists 124 groups that have been spied on by undercover police officers since 1968. Anti-nuclear, anti-fascist, anti-apartheid, feminist, anti-poll tax, animal rights groups, the Aldermaston Women's Peace Camp, CND, the National Union of Students and the National Union of Teachers were all infiltrated by government spies. They even infiltrated that renowned organization dedicated to general mayhem, anarchy and the overthrow of Western civilization, the Young Liberals. The government and their agents over the past several decades were taking no chances. However, what has changed is that over the last few years, pretty much all of those political groups, not on the right, with the notable exception of the Labour Party in Scotland, whose membership has been dropping like a stone, have coalesced around the notion of independence and have, if not buried their differences, certainly reprioritised them and have gathered round the flag, as it were. So we see the SNP, the Yes campaign, the Greens rise, the wonderful and majestic all under one banner movement, Solidarity, the Scottish Libertarian Party, Hope Over Fear, Women for Independence, Pensioners for Independence, and most recently, the Independence for Scotland Party, all gathering as one. In consequence, the forces of darkness have continued to work their evil ways to address this. In 2012, Prime Minister David Cameron was forced to the dispatch box to inform Parliament that an official inquiry into the 1989 murder of Northern Ireland lawyer Pat Finucane had discovered shocking levels of state collusion between loyalist paramilitary killers and MI5 police and military intelligence. British intelligence also paid Freddie Scapatici during the 30 years of the Troubles in Northern Ireland to infiltrate the IRA and kidnap, torture and kill on their behalf without being brought to justice. And in order to ensure that criminality of these and other offences went unnoticed, or if it was, that the reporting of that criminality was presented in soft focus, a unit within the BBC vetted all applicants to ensure that no one was employed who might offend their mission of serving the interests of the British state. The Observer revealed that MI5 have long been vetting BBC appointments, basing their operations in room 105 in Broadcasting House. MI5 were concerned not only that subversives might influence televised debate, but also that if the trade unions representing engineers were infiltrated by communists and the like, important coverage of a royal wedding or something might be sabotaged. The political vetting process was also designed to ensure that any staff who became contaminated with socialist or communist ideology following appointment could subsequently be denied promotion or attachment to duties deemed unwise. In addition to secretive infiltration of legal entities, the UK government's Investigatory Powers Act 2016 specifically permits the use of agents in criminality and permits a secret oversight mechanism known as the Third Direction in intelligence circles, whereby covert human intelligence sources may commit authorised criminality. These illegal acts have been available to agents for some considerable time, and certainly since the early 1990s, but were only brought under judicial review by a senior judge, Sir Mark Waller, in 2012, at which point he was instructed by Prime Minister David Cameron to examine only the operation of the policy, not to offer any opinion on whether any actions so undertaken were lawful or not. In summary, the British security services believe themselves permitted by governments of all stripes to be able to infiltrate any legal organisation, to interrogate without much regard to constraints on torture, and to authorise criminal behaviour by their agents. David Cameron formed the 77th Brigade as an adjunct of the Army in January 2015. It's based at Denison Barracks in Hermitage, Berkshire, and became operational in April of that year. Its stated aim is to challenge the difficulties of modern warfare using new technologies as a means to adapt behaviour of opposing forces and other adversaries. And I am here to tell you with a heavy heart that we here tonight, at least those of us not taking notes for the security services, are other adversaries. Well, the British government now has a substantial body of staff that are adept at creating new organisations, assuming false identities, inventing false flags, and who can infiltrate other bodies, create dissent, cause confusion, change dates of meetings, and so on. They've also become quite adept at hacking poster organisations and encouraging the result they've been asked to secure. So let's ask ourselves, is it at all fanciful to imagine that the British government would not stoop to these levels when they view the threat of Scottish independence? There can be little doubt that they're engaged in the Scottish situation as matters deteriorate from their perspective. Now, all of the foregoing are matters of fact and are capable of simple verification. Do your own Google checks. What follows in the narrative of my book, The Last Colony, is the fruit of my imagination, or is it? The British Empire over the last century has gradually fallen away to the point that, excluding the prospect of the reunification of Ireland, the only colony left available to them to plunder is Scotland, if we discount the reunification of Ireland and the independence of Wales and Cornwall. Scotland is Britain's last colony. It covers 32% of the area of the UK, but it's only 8% of its population, and 59 of 650 members of Parliament at Westminster, thereby locking itself into a political system that offers no democratic way of triggering its claim of right. And I don't have to rehearse here this evening all of the resources an independent Scotland would have in oil, freshwater, fisheries, renewable energies, whiskey, tourism, festivals, etc., etc. Nor do I have to delve into the problems an independent anti-nuclear Scotland would present to the English or the Americans. The Russian cold water fleet has to pass Cape Wrath at the very northwest of Scotland. Would the Americans be pleased that an anti-nuclear future member of NATO, on record as not being very fond of Donald Trump, would seek to rid itself of nuclear weapons? Might an independent Scotland hinder their sonar tracking devices at Cape Wrath? They can't be sure. So it's perhaps not unreasonable to assume that if the British state was prepared to do the kinds of things in Ulster and the rest of the United Kingdom, as I've already cited, why would they not attempt something similar in Scotland with the far more substantial amount of resources and strategic assets that we have up here? Scotland is Britain's last colony. But as the world enters the 21st century, Scottish independence is on the rise, according to polls. It threatens the status quo of the establishment, the economy, and the resources available to the United Kingdom. And one of the most dastardly ways in which this threat has been implemented is the use of dark money, the subject of my third book, Rebellious Scots to Crush. I took an interest in this subject because money, especially money whose donor cannot be traced and which can be spent on anything, allows merry hell to be played with the democratic rights of Scots. Dark money involves the substitution of informed political choice with the dissemination of corporate propaganda and fake facts by people with money, which, as we don't have the time in the run-up to an election or a referendum to check and refute, we've got little chance of resisting, especially if it's done in cahoots with the broadcast and print media, as typically it is. The Electoral Commission said the only action they can take on dark money is that once the campaign is over, and then the only penalties are fines, which these campaigns can simply cost into their budgets. We already know that a huge payment was made by Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party for newspaper adverts in the Metro, asking people to vote against independence and also for Brexit. Remarkably, this ad was not circulated in Northern Ireland where the money came from, but only in England and Scotland. A UK-wide wraparound advert in the Metro costs £250,000, according to Open Democracy. So this might suggest that someone was making use of Northern Ireland's secrecy regime, because political donations there have remained hidden from view, as not unreasonably in the past. If Maguire's the Butchers wanted to support Sinn Féin in Belfast, he'd like to do so without his shop being targeted by Ulster Unionists. So any anonymous funder wishing to disguise their identity could use Northern Ireland as a back channel into UK politics. But after sustained pressure, the DUP were forced to reveal that the money came from a donation of £425,000 and change passed through an organisation called the Constitutional Research Council. But still, the original source of that money remains a mystery. Although electoral law in Great Britain states that a donation of more than £500 cannot be accepted if the donation is from a source that cannot be identified, the Democratic Unionist Party and its leader Arlene Foster claims that it doesn't need to know who provided this money. In a great article by George Monbiot of The Guardian, one of the few remaining journalists, along with Carol Cadwallader and one or two others who can sleep at night by using that job title to describe their output, he described the Constitutional Research Council as run by a man some of us know here called Richard Cook, a senior, if electorally challenged, Conservative who lives in the south side of Glasgow. He seems unlikely to have been the original source given the amounts expended. What else do we know about him? Monbiot cites an organization called Open Democracy, which discovered in 2013 that he'd established a company called Five Star Investments, 75% of which was owned, according to Monbiot, by Prince Nawal Al Saud, the former head of Saudi Arabian intelligence. And Nawaf's son is currently the Saudi ambassador to the UK. While Cook has denied any foreign funding for the CRC, he's not yet explained himself, although according to Open Democracy, he has admitted to have had a role in funneling the £425,000 to the DUP's Brexit campaign. Worryingly, there are various other ways in which dark money is spent. One of them is astroturfing, the creation of fake grassroots movements. We saw this during the referendum on Scottish independence, when new member-less organisations were given airtime by the BBC in order to oppose Scottish self-government. Another outlet for dark money are the organisations that call themselves think tanks, but which are essentially covertly funded lobbyists. The less transparent they are, the greater their presence in the media. How often do we see their representatives interviewed in the media without any questions asked, which might show them as less than dispassionate observers? It's important that people can have confidence in the integrity of the research. And if you're concealing the sources of funding, that's relevant, as people don't know how your research might be motivated. But presently in Scotland and the UK, it's open season. And these polling organisations, think tanks, research institutions are all over the BBC, the Today programme, Question Time and the rest, and other media. Finally, because the dark money is dark and untraceable, who actually knows how it's being spent? I hope in my book, Rebellious Scots to Crush, brings some light to bear on what might be facing Scotland as we head for another bite at the cherry. So, in thanking again the magnificent All Under One Banner movement for allowing me to blether away, I'm happy to take questions on any of the Independence trilogy books, on the death of Willie McRae, on the last colony and infiltration into the Scottish government, and my unfinished book, Rebellious Scots to Crush, and its theme of dark money. Thank you for your attention.
Ron, thank you very much indeed for that fantastic talk. That was just brilliant. I'm watching the feedback from everyone who's listening and watching in Zoom and on Facebook, and everyone has been commenting on how much they've been enjoying the talk and everything that you've been saying. That was just great. There's one question's popped up here and from Jim Barlow, and we'll get to that in a moment. I was also going to say just how much I enjoyed myself and didn't at all expect to find myself listening to hearing the names Pat Finucane and Freddie Scapaticci, State Knife, in the middle of the conversation this evening. So that was an unexpected pleasure. Thank you. But I think none of us present are at all surprised to hear tales of the activities of the British government in its attempts to stymie and interfere with the will of the Scottish people. And the names like Richard Cook popping up come as no surprise. So thank you very much indeed for that very entertaining and very informative talk as a starter for this part of this evening. People are saying it was excellent, it was very thought-provoking, and everybody is saying thank you already. So first things first, I was going to talk a little bit, or I was going to ask you a little bit more generally, with your background in politics in Scotland going back 50 years, I was going to talk to you a little bit just to reflect on what you think has happened to the independence campaign and to the independence movement since you became involved after the referendum. On reflection, what do you see as having happened over the last 5-6 years?
Two main characteristics which impress and trouble me, I guess, is that I think that the Scottish government has been able to demonstrate competence. And I think that's had a material impact on voter support for independence compared with what's happening down south. The worry I have, the trouble I have, and what keeps me awake at night, in fact, it was reflected in an article I noticed in the National this morning, was... And it's something that I'm told is characterised by every independence movement as it approaches the denouement, and that is splits and arguments and differences and other issues coming up about the sexual politics or whatever. And all of a sudden, you get arguments about my independence is better than your independence. Oh, gee, dear God, you know, behave. Let's, you know, let's deal with priorities here. So I think that's one thing that troubles me, and one thing that presses me, in fact, has been every day at 12:30, it's appointment to television up in my son's house, because I don't have a TV license. I won't pay for the BBC propaganda, but I do visit my son to watch Nicola blethering away on BBC every day. And I think it demonstrates, you can compare and contrast her presentation and the results of that with Boris Johnson and his shit show down the road.
I think that's absolutely right. I've not seen viewing figures for the First Minister's briefing, because they carefully split it across two channels, which probably has an effect. But I absolutely agree. It's definitely destination television at the moment, and there's undoubtedly a connection between the approval ratings that we see both for the First Minister and the Prime Minister. And I think our friends at Business for Scotland have published some polling this morning, which underlines that again. It underlines both the sharp contrast in approval between the First Minister and the Prime Minister. And it's an interesting poll also in terms of people's view of Brexit, would you believe? So if people are interested, have a look at the Business for Scotland website. Their polling that they published today is very interesting indeed. I've got a question here from John McDougall on Facebook. John McDougall asks, Ron, how are we going to stop the Tories closing down or severely downgrading Holyrood?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I'm not a politician. I'm a writer, and I write entertainments. I mean, one of the things I should have mentioned, but that I was trying to compress the first contribution to make it within your limit of 30 minutes. So I write entertainment. So I don't write dry, dusty biographical accounts. I tell a tale. And the way I do that is by nailing down the facts of a situation and then weaving within that a story, which makes it difficult to tell what is fiction, what is narrative, and what is the truth or the facts. But I am not a great sophologist. I'm not sure how to answer a lot of these political questions. I'll leave that to the politicians.
Understandably so. We've got a question also from Steve Kane. And if Steve would like to ask the question of you, we will unmute Steve and we'll go to him.
Yes, I can hear you. Thank you very much. Ron, so the question then, I'm wondering, is do you think that the connections between Donald Trump and Boris Johnson are working not only to push Brexit, but also possibly stunt independence at the same time?
I imagine that these two idiots are... The problem I've got is that I don't think Donald Trump is capable of strategic thought. I honestly don't. I think the man is... over here we have a terminology called numpties. And Donald Trump exemplifies that. So it's difficult to imagine that he is anything other than a telephone relationship with Johnston. Johnston is a bit more sleek-it or sly than Trump, I suspect. But yeah, I think both of them would have a shared interest. There's no question that, in my view, that they have similar interests in narrowing the state, hence Dominic Cummings over in the UK, trying to pare back the civil service, reduce the public spend and so forth, other than this pandemic that they're dealing with just now. I'm sure they're both of similar mind, but I'm less concerned with Trump, other than the fact he might blow the world up at any moment, and more concerned with Johnston, who does seem to me to be, I just can't believe the man where in one minute he has us out clapping for nurses, and then the next minute he tells me you've got to pay to go to your work because we're taking car parking away from you. The Tory behaviour is just reprehensible, but they've got an 80 majority, they're in power for 4 years, and I think that they feel they can do untold damage between now and then. They gave away billions of pounds in contracts through legislation they put through, emergency legislation they put through for the COVID virus. And all of it is without tender. And we find organisations which have got 30 bob in the bank, getting umpteen million pounds to spend on PPE equipment where they have no track record whatsoever in being able to produce that. So it's desperately worrying, and I'm not sure how, other than pretty dramatic events like removing our politicians from Westminster and making a dramatic stand, how we will capture their attention.
That was fantastic. Thanks, Ron. That was just great. The point, the stories, as you say, that are coming out with regard to the Horlick Family Investment Company, for example, and their huge contract to supply PPE when they're an investment house. It beggars belief. Now, we have a question here from Valerie Gold. We'll unmute Val. Val, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Thanks. Hi, Ron. Thanks very much indeed for your talk. It's very illuminating. You mentioned the point about infiltrators, and I'm just thinking, I'm one of the people that came into the SNP like a huge influx of new members after the referendum in 2014, at a time when a lot of branches quadrupled and even more their membership. And I'm wondering, to what extent, have you any idea at all, to what extent like local branches may have been infiltrated, and if so, what could yeah, like your normal punters like us do to guard against that? Is there anything?
The British establishment wouldn't be doing their job if they didn't infiltrate organisations like the SNP. Their job is to secure and look after, protect the British state, and more importantly to them, the British establishment. The same as the BBC. The BBC isn't interested in serving the needs of the people of Scotland. The BBC's remit is to look after the United Kingdom, not the people of Scotland. So we get, there was a broadcast the other night there, and it was positive, and I sat, my jaw was dropping. I thought, well, there you go. It was a positive comment. But the question is there kind of, is there infiltration? Well, you just need to look at that John Swinney. If he's not a Bond villain, I don't know who is. But seriously, I of course there will be infiltration. Of course there will. If you just need to look at how they've deployed agents over the years, and all of these organisations that I mean, all of these legal organisations that I mentioned, and they've got infiltrated by Special Branch and MI5 agents. So it's without question, it's their job. They're good at it. They would not be doing their job if they didn't infiltrate organisations. And the perfect opportunity, as you quite rightly say, Valerie, was when after the referendum, when the membership of the SNP just exploded. That was the perfect time to put some people in there. So I'm very cautious about it. I have a friend who is a member of Sinn Féin and was not uninvolved in the Troubles, and he still takes the view that he'll only deal with three other people in a unit. He will not go out with that group. It's the way the IRA used to operate, so that they couldn't be infiltrated or less likely to be infiltrated. But of course, you can't operate like that in a political environment in Scotland. So inevitably, there will be some mischief afoot. But the reason you won't be able to pick them out is that they're good at their job.
That was a great question, Val, and a great answer. Thanks, Ron. And actually, there's a follow-up question from somebody watching on Facebook, which is closely related. Habib Steele asks, Ron, do you think, is there any evidence that the SNP has been infiltrated by MI5?
Well, it's the same answer, same question, same answer. I'm sure that they have. I have absolutely no evidence that that's been the case. But I don't know how you would, how even after independence, I'm not sure how you would go about weaning out of the establishment in Scotland those people who were put there by the British or English establishment in this instance.
It's a very good question. I was about to suggest the kind of processes that were undergone in the former East Germany with the removal of the Stasi and their record keeping, but it would be a very different situation. So no, I agree. Achieving that can only take time, I think.
Yeah, that's the way.
And certainly the point is that if we were able easily to detect such people, then they wouldn't be doing their jobs.
I might say just in conclusion there that a very interesting comment in The Guardian that I tweeted the other day there, where somebody was arguing in The Guardian in the comments section after an article on Scottish independence, they were arguing that Scotland would not be welcomed by Europe because the Eurocrats would always be suspicious that the Scots would be working for the English. Good luck with that one, pal.
That seems extremely unlikely, but yes. And I think my own view would be that Scotland's connections with Europe and European institutions, I mean, historically, not the current European institutions, going back 600 years, would at least give us a reasonable hearing insofar as we have a long track record of cooperating with European institutions, not on behalf of the English, would be my argument. We've got a question on from Facebook from Lee Lindsay. Lee asks, does Ron believe, as I do, that the Johnson administration would happily allow the Scots to decline into impoverishment, recreating a cap-in-hand nation as in years previously, ripe for the plunder of its resources?
Well, yeah, that's the kind of theme of the last colony. But I think Johnson is an absolute cretin of the first water. And he changes positions, U-turns on a dime. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if, I mean, I saw a recent boost in support for independence for England. And if that became a sufficient groundswell, he may just say, look, this is not worth the hassle. I'm told also that the Chancellor, Sunak, is also a businessman who say, why are we doing this? Let Scotland go and we'll just look after matters down here in England. So who knows? Who knows how it's going to transpire?
No, I think that's very fair. There's a comment here from Facebook. Gabrielle Rita came to Scotland in 1989 to research small parties in Europe. Their PhD thesis argued to establish federal systems. However, they're now convinced that independence is the only way forward due to the limitations of the British state and the difference in culture and population and aspirations of the culture and the populations. Any response to that comment?
Yeah, more likely that there'll be more of us left alive after the COVID virus as well.
definitely. Indicating the breadth of the independence movement and the networks that we establish and we work hard to maintain, this Zoom meeting is being restreamed by Indie Live Radio and on Indie Live and Val's friends there. And we've got a question from there from Paul, who asks, Ron, do you think in the future we'll find that the 2014 independence referendum was actually a yes vote?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because there was a lot of stuff I read after the event, and I've had conversation with my pals, some of whom are watching this, about the extent to which postal ballots can be footered with. And one of my friends who had a responsibility for that insists, can't be, there's no way. But I've also been reading of an ex-Tory minister whose name escapes me just now, who owns a company, and their job is to look at ballots and make sure that everything's tickety-boo before they pass them on for approval. And if that's the case, you just got to ask the question, you know, to what extent is there opportunities for mischief there? So I would love to see a system in Scotland whereby it was foolproof, and you knew that if a postal ballot was submitted, that it would be an honest and accurate account of the numbers voting. There was, I think it was Argyll who were saying that they did a check on people coming out the ballots, and it was a huge vote, and yet when the results came in, it was the reverse that was the case. So either people were lying in great number as they came out the polling booths, or there was some footering going on.
I think that's right. The research in Argyll is extremely interesting. It was a significant piece of work, because the local authorities and the electoral authorities were not very keen on releasing the data that was required, but they did persevere and they did get there. And I was about to say, and Val Gold is also saying, the former Tory politician you're talking about is Peter Lilly.
Yeah.
If people want to go and have a quick Google for it, the research that was carried out in Argyll is quite compelling. I think it was also to do with the volume of postal voting in the constituency being very, very different from that which had ever been seen ever before. So we've got a couple more questions here. Firstly, we've got a question from Llewellyn Smith, but we'll come to that in a moment. To keep the flow of the current line of questioning going, we'll go to Jim Maxwell if we can.
Hello, Ron. Hi. Great talk. I was just wondering whether you feel that there's any, you know, with regard to the Willie McRae situation and all the evidence that you've brought together, do you think there's any likelihood at all that the government, the present government or the police might want to pick up on that and actually seek out what the real truth is?
No, Jim, thanks for your question. You're looking lovely today, I might say. I should say, Jim is a friend of mine, a horticulturalist musician friend of mine. I don't think so. There would, Angiolini, the heat bummer in the Justice Department has knocked back the request. There was a crowdfunded request to investigate this further, but it was for a fatal accident inquiry, which is the wrong way to go about it, because it wasn't an accident. It should be a murder inquiry. But it's never been undertaken. Indeed, I was part of a small group which investigated Willie McRae's death. It re-interviewed people from 30 years before. And unfortunately, at the very end, nobody was involved, but the chairman decided just to issue a statement saying, it was suicide. They hired two retired cops. And my first question at my first meeting was, well, how do we know that these guys aren't MI5 or special branch? And so one was an inspector and one a detective inspector, one a detective sergeant, and they steered the decision of this review group to suicide, but without involving the rest of us. And I made the point that if I was MI5 and I knew that there was this well-publicized group of people reviewing a controversial case of this nature, why would I not say, you're getting $6,000 each, I'll give you $10,000. And here's your job to bring it over to this decision here. So they've had ample opportunities to review this and haven't. So I suspect that this cottage industry on McRae will continue and continue and continue, because none of us know what happened. You can surmise what happened. And there are people, senior conservatives, who, of course, it's self-serving in their interest. They don't want some of these stories to come out, who argued it was absolutely suicide. And you've got people like me who raise an eyebrow at that particular judgment.
Of course, no, thank you. We've got a question here now from a friend of all under one banner, Llewellyn Smith.
Well, just put it there, I'm Llewellyn Smith, I'm from Wales. I'm, as well as campaigning for Welsh independence, I am in support of you guys for independence as well in Scotland. And I'm hoping to go to your march which is meant to be, well, trying to sign in October this year or potentially next year, from what I understand, in Edinburgh. Support you guys. And just to say as well, thank you all for supporting us in our marches, if any of you attended them last year in Cardiff, Carnarvon, or in Merthyr Tydfil. Yeah, my question is, same with Babylon, in the event of independence of both Wales and Scotland, if we both achieve it, which I'm hopefully we will, is there then a possibility of our nations forming a Celtic alliance with each other, along with Ireland, Cornwall, Isle of Man, Brittany?
Yeah, well, I'd like to think so. I used to be involved with the Scottish Enterprise, and I was involved in economic development, and I was working with the OECD for a while, who came to Glasgow, and I was sitting talking to the guy, the senior guy from the OECD, a French guy from Paris, and he looked at a map. And he drew a box, as it were, or lines around Ireland, Wales, Scotland, over into Norway, Sweden, Denmark. And he called it the Nordic Arc. And he reckoned that would be a very effective economic base. And I think he's right. And in a narrower context, I do think that the Celtic Union is something that's much to be desired. And if and when Scotland becomes independent, it will rent asunder the United Kingdom. The problem Wales has got, as you know better than I, Llewellyn, is you've got a very long border with England. In Scotland, when you cross the border, you drive for an hour before you see a chimney. So there's a long way to go before you reach the hinterland of Scotland. But in terms of the proportion of the population that's moving across from England into Wales, it's not insubstantial. And in consequence, I would imagine that will dampen the prospects of independence for a while. But I think if Scotland gets, when Scotland gets the green light, so too will Ireland, so too will Wales, and God bless, so too, I hope, Cornwall.
That's fantastic. Thanks, Ron. We've got a question here from Keith Brown on Facebook. Ron, what do you think of what was said in the Court of Session in Edinburgh this week about the English Magna Carta having no standing in Scotland?
Well, it's just a matter of fact. It's hardly, I mean, that Scotland predated the Magna Carta, so it hardly applies up here. And it makes the more general point that I imagine that there's going to be some court action. I'm sure that there will be some court action just to say, look, hold on a minute. This is a union. The UK isn't a country. It's a union of four countries. And this has to be sorted in court, that if the Scots have the willingness to go independent, who's to say that they can't? So I hope it's got wider application.
Absolutely. A number of us were very impressed by some of the very careful and judicial drafting in that opinion, which pointed out that at that time, England was independent from Scotland, which was very judicial, but it made the point. Also on Facebook, Johnny Rudkin's asking, is the English elite still screwing Scotland out of our oil and gas with all the new fields? We seem to be the only country to get poorer the more oil and gas we find.
Well, that's for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how the quantity of gas and oil under the North Sea increases and decreases depending upon whether there's a referendum in the horizon or not. I still remember Ian Wood saying, oh, that's the bonus slates. There's no more gas. There's no more oil. We're finished. We're doomed. And as soon as the election and the referendum's out the way, we're opening up a field here. We're opening up a field there. And interestingly, the one I'm interested in is the extent to which we can explore the west coast of Scotland. My understanding is it's the MOD who will not allow exploration in the fields that they expect on the west coast because it might interfere with their nuclear submarines. Well, I've got a wee solution for that one.
I think that's absolutely right. And you're correct. It's the Admiralty who put the kibosh on the applications for licenses to explore the Clyde Basin in 1975, I think. We've got probably two questions here that we can bracket together. My apologies to Jim Barlow. He's been waiting for his question, but it's bracketed with one that seems appropriate here too. So I'll do the two together. And I'm grateful to Jim for his question and for holding on. Jim asks, do you think that Tommy Sheridan, and also I'll preface this by saying, this is a public meeting, so no defamation, please. So Jim's question is, do you think that Tommy Sheridan, when he set up the Scottish Socialist Party, was himself set up by the British state? And there's a related, but I'll bracket these two questions together, if I may. And on YouTube, Lenny is asking a question for Ron. Does Ron think that the SNP at the highest level has been infiltrated? Questions about both parties there.
Craig Murray, a man I admire a lot, was of the view that not only was Tommy Sheridan set up, so too was Alex Salmond. Not necessarily that they did or did not do, without comment on their actions, would the security services make sure that the Times and the Telegraph and so forth all had as much information as they needed to prosecute that story as widely as possible? But I know and like Tommy, and he is a dedicated campaigner, completely supportive of Scottish independence. And of course, he's going to be a person who is of interest to the security service. Of course he is. And so it wouldn't surprise me one bit if he heard clicks in his phone every so often when he was phoning his mammy.
Yes, well, the even nowadays, the notorious double click and then hearing your own voice back if you pick up the handset again. Say no more about that. We've got a question here from Kyle, who's in the Zoom call.
I first want to make a quick comment just on something you said just in the last couple of minutes, Ron, about the oil on the West Coast. There is huge evidence there is oil in the West Coast, actually more than there is in the North Sea. But oil is not the answer. We shouldn't be using oil, given what's happening to the climate, et cetera, et cetera. So just kind of want your opinion on that. But I was also going to say that earlier on, you were on about, and I support independence. I support independence. I'm not against it. But I'm very I'm very sceptical about whether an independent Scotland would actually be in the EU if it did go independent. Because number one, just because the majority of people in Scotland voted to remain in the EU, that was when they were part of the UK. It's not the same question that an independent Scotland, people in Scotland would vote to be part of the EU. Probably would. They probably would. I'm not, but it's not the same question. They are different questions. Even then, I think there would need to be a referendum once we were independent, once we were independent. Do you want the Scottish administration to apply for membership of the EU? And that, again, that, what I'm saying is it might not be a straightforward yes to that. The third point, but it's the same question. All 27 remaining countries in the EU would have to say yes to allow Scotland to join their thing. Now, I genuinely don't think Spain would allow it. Places like Montenegro, Kosovo, places that I've got regional issues. Spain, I've got Catalonia, the Basque region, you know, so I genuinely don't think an independent Scotland would actually get in the EU as easily as what you hinted at earlier on.
Sorry, Ron, I was just going to say, it's a couple of years since I was last there. The last time I was in Montenegro, it wasn't in the EU. It may have exceeded now. And I think it's fairly clear that the Spanish authorities recognise that once Scotland is independent, it is then a completely different set of circumstances from their difficulties with Catalonia, which is a region. If Scotland is an independent country, then the Catalonia question, if you will, doesn't arise. But sorry, Ron, I'll shut up and let you.
Thanks, Kyle. I'm not sure that I did say it would be easy for Scotland to. I don't think I mentioned Europe, but you made the three points there. The first of which was oil. The Scottish government, I think, very cleverly has never predicated their economic cause, economic argument for independence on oil. Never predicated it in that. They've always talked about the base Scottish economy, with the oil being the cherry on the top. And I very much take the point that why not leave it in the ground? The value to me is of long term, because the issue is about whether we want aeroplanes flying across the sky and polluting the place. But that's different from oil. Oil is always going to be of value in engineering and other places. They're always going to need oil, but not for green purposes, not necessarily for pollution purposes. So it's better to have it under the ground and exploit it as you deem it appropriate rather than not. Secondly, the Europe thing is easy to resolve. You just ask people once we're independent, what do you want to do? And do you want to join Europe? Do you want to join EFTA? Do you not want to bother? It's up to the Scottish people to decide. Whether whether Spain would want to oppose it, they might not, but I would be surprised if they did. They're looking at a bigger picture, because it's different from Catalonia. Catalonia is not a country. Scotland is a country. Catalonia is an area of Spain. So I don't think it'll offend their sensibilities too much.
That's great. Thank you. It was a great question, Kyle. And Ron, that was very clear. It's been pointed out to me, an article from the World Economic Forum from this more or less almost exactly a year ago, that at that point, Scotland was generating 182% of its domestic requirements from electricity from green sources. So we were just about able to provide enough power for double the number of homes in the country not using oil at all. So we are heading in that direction. But I agree, we need to find the greening and decarbonising of large sections of the Scottish economy is an important argument. And it's something that we've been pursuing, but as ever, with at least one hand tied behind our backs. But that was a great question, Kyle, and a great answer as well, Ron. Thank you. I think we've reached the stage now where we've had a fantastic talk by Ron, and a very interesting discussion from everybody who had questions in the room, covering a wide range of topics. And Ron, I'm extremely grateful to you for engaging in that constructive and positive way on such a wide range of topics of which you had no notice. So you've done fantastically well this evening, and it's added on top of what was a great talk already. So thank you for agreeing to spend your Friday evening with us. Thank you for your insights and thoughts and ideas that we heard through the discussion. And I know and I can see that everyone here has enjoyed it immensely. On Saturday, the 1st of August, there would have been an All Under One Banner march in Kirkcaldy. We were working extremely hard on the arrangements and we were expecting it to be a fantastic event. Instead, for now, there will be an online Ceilidh on Broadcasting Scotland that evening. We are hope to have as many performers who are local to Fife taking part, and maybe one or two wee surprises as well. So please search for Broadcasting Scotland on YouTube and enjoy the show on the evening of Saturday, the 1st of August. All Under One Banner will host more online talks and discussions here on Zoom through July and beyond. Coming up are Dave Sherry talking about John McLean, then a legal panel discussion with Mike Daly, Michael Gray and Caroline Welsh, and then a historical discussion on the borders of Scotland and how they came to be with Bruce Fummy. Please look out for these events on All Under One Banner social media. There will also be All Under One Banner demonstrations in the months ahead, not marches. Each carefully, extremely carefully organised and appropriate for the circumstances that we will find ourselves in at that time. More information about those will be posted on Facebook and on All Under One Banner's other social media in the very near future. All Under One Banner is persevering through the current adversity, and I know that everyone else is doing their very best too. We're not going away, and we will continue to campaign for independence. You will see announcements in the press and online during the rest of this month, and you can be sure that we are working away behind the scenes on plans for a number of things for the months to come. In the meantime, thank you again to Ron, and thank you to Carol and Brian and everyone else who's working behind the scenes. And thank you to everyone for joining us here tonight, especially those of you who have asked such great questions. We'll draw this evening's discussion to a conclusion in the circumstances. Thank you, Ron. And in the meantime, thank you to everybody. We are All Under One Banner. Good night.